The following Dharma encounter with Jeffrey Shug and Arnold Roshi took place at Zen Mountain Monastery at the conclusion to a week-long meditation session. As you'll hear, Dharma encounters begin with the introduction of a topic related to Zen practice and training. Students then volunteer to present their understanding of the topic or a question for the Dharma encounter teacher to reflect on. The presence of fellow students means that anyone in attendance can benefit from the exchange. We hope you enjoy.
So this morning's Dharma encounter is, as we do during Ango, we have one of these forms of training and teaching at the end of each session, and then at the end of next month's session will be what in Japanese is Shuso Hosen. Shuso normally is head monk. They're the chief disciple is the translation we use. And so next month, Kiju, who's the chief disciple for the Ango, will offer some Dharma words on a koan and then take up Dharma encounter with all of you. And so this is both just part of our regular training and also helps us prepare for that day. Hogen Sensei spoke a bit about a Dharma encounter last month, so I'll make those remarks brief. It traces itself back to the Buddha. It's basically one of the particular ways of encountering between the student and teacher, one of the ways that teachings are conveyed. There's Doksan, there's Mando, question and answer, there's Taisho, the formal talks each Sunday during Sesshin as well. There's ordinary interactions and there's Dharma encounter. And so this is public as opposed to interview and Doksan, which is confidential and private. And so this is, gives everyone an opportunity to experience everyone together and to hear from new students and more experienced students as we take up some point of the Dharma and examine it together. And the point of this, as is true with all of our training, is to develop our meditation, to live in accord with our moral being, and bring forth great compassion, and to awaken our mind from delusion. And so this morning, what I wanted to do is continue drawing from Dogen's Genjo Koan, and in particular, I wanted to sort of pick up from the Fusatsu that I did on Friday evening in that fascicle and some of the points that I was making then. And so I'll reiterate some of that as a way to get into this morning. So in that section of the Genjo Koan, this teaching by Master Dogen, Genjo Koan is translated the way of everyday life. And so in this section, Dogen says, when a fish swims in the ocean, there is no limit to the water, no matter how far it swims. When a bird flies in the sky, there is no limit to the air, no matter how far it flies. However, no fish or bird has ever left its element since the beginning. When the need is large, it's used largely. When the need is small, it's used in a small way. And so no creature ever comes short of its own completion. Completeness. Wherever it stands, it doesn't fail to cover the ground. If a bird leaves the air, it will die at once. If a fish leaves the water, it will die at once. Know then that water is life, air is life, life is the bird, life is the fish. And beyond these, there are further implications and ramifications. And in this way, there's practice and enlightenment, mortality and immortality. And so I spoke a little bit about the moral teachings and how the Buddha spoke of humans, us, as fundamentally moral beings. We experience pain and pleasure. We can act in a way that affirms life. We can act in a way that is destructive of life. And because of those factors, and because we can choose what we do, we have a sort of basic morality within us. Because we can choose to create harm or to do good. We can choose to go a skillful way or an unskillful way. We're moral beings and constantly faced with moral decisions. And I spoke of the moral teachings as our inner morality, and to think of it that way, so they're not so much sort of a set of moral teachings that have been brought from the outside in, but rather they're originating from our basic nature and are just being expressed through the precepts and the other moral teachings that we practice. Fish and birds live in a moral universe of their own. They have their own way of living in harmony within their element and with their neighbors. Whether they have intention or not is their business, right? And they seem to do pretty well. Our moral teachings rise from our element, in this case, our basic nature, our non-dual nature, arising from emptiness. And so how we think and speak and act when it's arising from our moral basic nature, when it's in alignment with that, is what we describe as an enlightened being. And sometimes that's with intention, oftentimes, but not always. And so in that way, following the precepts, we restrain from being destructive of life. So we killing, stealing, misusing sexuality, being deceptive, distorting our natural mind's clarity, using language to hurt and divide, to be stingy, to hold back and not give what we could give and would be helpful, to give rein to our anger, to turn against the three treasures, which in its larger sense is everything. And while we're doing that, we are affirming life. We're being generous, being honest, taking care of each other, speaking in a way that is compassionate and non-divisive. And when we do those, when we live this way, when we swim well, fly well within our element, I said that we'll know it, right? There's an affirmation that comes from within, that we have a sense that we're in some way, even if we don't fully understand it, that there's a kind of rightness. There's something that is affirming of that, even if it's difficult. I've spoken about how in my very early days of doing Zazen, which were difficult, and I thought I'm not very good at this, and, you know, familiar to most beginning students. And yet, even though I experienced that, there was a feeling that somehow this was good and true. I couldn't explain that. I wouldn't have been able to say why or say anything more. And so I really didn't say anything. But I felt it. And I didn't understand it, but I did feel it. And we will know that we're moving in accord with the way because we'll see a lack or a diminishment in our inner conflict, our distress, our worry, our fear, our regret over things done that we regret, our worry, anticipating the future. We'll know it by the inner state of stability, less reactivity, all the things that the Dharma speaks of. We'll see those arising. They can be very incipient, very slight, very dim, but there's something. There's something moving. When we don't move well within our element, if we pay attention, we will know that too. That will give rise to signs, qualities, characteristics, experiences within that let us know that we're doing something that is moving away from our basic nature. It's as though the bird is trying to leave the sky. Dogen says, if they do that, that bird will die at once, and a fish leaving the water will die at once. And I spoke about how we, in our trying to leave our element, our basic nature, turn against it, act contrary to the way, to the Dharma, which is the basic nature of things. It's just the Buddhism's way of speaking of it. Buddhism didn't create this reality, didn't create our basic nature. The Buddha just realized it. And that when we do turn against that, there's a kind of death that happens. And I said we can live our lives dying innumerable small deaths and big ones. And because of the nature of our mind and our capacity to rationalize, explain, distract, redirect, deny, suppress, We can do that almost without knowing. But why would we distract, avoid, blame, suppress, but for in some way we do know? There's something that we do not want. We don't want to face this. We do not want to be engaged in this. And so we engage in a way that seems to protect us, a kind of death, a loss or diminishment of the basic qualities of our good nature, of our basic nature, of our stability of mind. It makes our meditation very difficult. It strengthens false views. We can think of it as working contrary to the cultivation of the four measurables, compassion, loving kindness, gladness, and equanimity. And these deaths happen. They happen on the spot when we turn around, but when we turn away, but we may not notice. But the more we practice, we do. We do notice. And sometimes that, and while that is always good news for the practitioner, we don't always see it that way, right? Because now we are experiencing what we have in many ways tried not to. We can feel the pain of turning against the way, right? And so in that way, the moral teachings, our inner morality, calls to us. That's why it's so important not to see the precepts as rules being imposed. In the same way that when we are acting more in accord, and think of this as a spectrum, you know, it's not all or nothing, it's not on or off. And so these shifts away or towards can be very slight, they can be very decisive. But when we are moving more in accord, we will feel that. Our lives will speak of that, our inner world will speak of that and affirm that. So the questions then that I want to take up, or how do you face a fish who has left its water? A bird who is estranged from their sky? In other words, how do you face a person who is living outside or apart from or in conflict with their basic nature? Without getting lost yourself in their lostness? Without stepping away from your basic nature? At the same time, without trying to preserve or hold on to some mental state that you might have or think you should have. How do we meet sentient beings in all of their various states? How do we do that? How do we learn to do that? And how do we do that understanding that there's an action that's happening in that moment? Something is being said, something is being acted upon. It is having an effect. It might be wonderful, it might be terrible. How do we meet that? Within the way. When the action of someone's is large, then the need tends to be large to address it. And yet oftentimes, as we know, those actions are not within our control. So in that way, in those moments, what is living within your element, using your wings, your fins, what you have? How do you bring your strong thoughts and emotions into your ocean, into your sky, into the path, rather than trying to avoid them? How do you bring them in and then let them help you? See them as difficult friends trying to help you. What does that mean? More importantly, what is it? And beyond any sense of poetry or metaphor or idealized notion of spiritual practice, how does that guide you when meeting the same or similar strong words and emotions in another? Dogen says, when the truth does not fill our body and mind, we think we have enough. When the truth fills our body and mind, we realize something's missing. How can we know? What are the signs for when we think we have enough? I spoke yesterday about pride, spiritual pride and arrogance. What might we be missing? How can we clarify this? How can we have a sense that there's something we don't know and we don't know? And then finally, Dogen says, although ordinary life and enlightened life assume many aspects, we can only recognize and understand through practice what the penetrating power of our vision can reach. And I emphasize what I feel like is the importance of that. I said we should write that down on a piece of paper and paste it to the end of our nose. Dawei said that we should, I'm borrowing that from him, he said we should take the question of life and death and paste it here so we don't forget. So when facing a burning house where the occupants, who are the stewards, the caretakers, the protectors of that house, are burning the house down themselves, how do these teachings in our practice help us understand the bodies and minds of self and others? What inspires you to continue to cease from harm, practice good and actualize good for others when people around you are not? And they seem to be benefiting, profiting, getting accolades, getting the good stuff. How do you keep going when your efforts, when we're in the presence of people who are conducting efforts or actions that have such large consequences, and yours may seem very small, the effects of your actions? How do you stay inspired? How do you stay clear-minded as Dharma practitioners? And these are the questions I want to look at with all of you. And so today I'd like to I want to focus on those of you who are here for the session and heard the Fusatsu talk and have just been here with the week. It would be nice to have some monastics, some seniors, lay seniors, some residents, some experienced and newer students. If there's an Australian in the house, that would be nice. And Kiju, and if you did it last month, then please hold on to your seat so folks can do it who weren't able to do it last month. And Kiju will start.
Sure, Zinjai. That was a lot to look at. I suppose one of them was looking when the fish has left the water, and I can in my experience can see it. And the one I suppose that I find most difficult is say, if I can see someone, but they're very angry and their anger is directed at me, that's when I can lose my equilibrium, as it were. That's when I can feel my ego, my fear, difficult.
Mm-hmm. And what is it that's being threatened at that moment?
Some inner child, I think, normally would not be physical, it would be more of and I'm off balance.
Who's being threatened at that moment? When somebody's angry at you, who feels threatened?
I do.
Yeah, you do.
Yes.
And so, where is that self that is being threatened and is reacting directly and tangibly with anger at that moment? Where is that self that is being threatened?
It feels somewhere. It feels here.
But when you look, what have you seen? Where is that self?
Some past, some something, some...
Have you ever found it?
No.
Then how is it that the anger still arises as a result of feeling threatened?
D- uh, old patterns, some old karmas.
So at that moment, that self, which you, in your own direct experience, cannot find,
yes,
is present. Like a magician.
Yes.
Creating an illusion that seems so real.
Yes.
Did you actually react?
Yes.
Right? Without thinking.
Yes.
And so how does that help you? How can that help you when you encounter that kind of impulsive consciousness in another person?
Well, see that this is arising in them, but see that my reaction as, or not being so reactive, because it doesn't help, frankly. I can't change them, but I can be more centered myself, mm-hmm, and not put it onto them.
And that can change them.
Me being centered, yes, definitely. If I'm centered.
That, if you think of that as an action.
Yes.
It will have consequence, right?
Yes.
It doesn't mean that they will suddenly become calm and peaceful. But it is an action that,
yes,
will have consequence. As in the same way that if you get angry and act out of that anger, that is an action that will certainly have consequence. Okay, may your life go well.
Thank you.
So Sanchi, there was a lot of things that you mentioned. I guess one of the things I think about...
I spoke about all of them before, right?
I thought
that would make it easier.
Easier. But I'd like to ask about all of them, but I think that would take too much time.
It would.
Most of my friends, most of my newer friends, actually all of them, have no idea where I really am right now, because I haven't told any of them about.
Do you lie to them?
Well, I don't lie to them, but I just tell them I'm doing some like IT work, which is technically, which is not wrong. But I'm going to have to come clean at some point.
What are you preserving?
I don't think I'm really preserving anything. I just I listen to people's reactions about spiritual practice, what they think about it, and I think, is it really...
But that's their reactions.
So that's
what
reaction.
Are you afraid of? What do you think is going to happen?
Nothing, but I wanted to be...
Well, come on. That's not true.
Well, I wanted to
then
be more tactful about it.
Why wouldn't you tell them if you thought nothing would happen?
I just don't want it to be taken as, some other fad, or Zen is...
Is it a fad for you?
No.
Then why do you think they would take it that way?
Because I hear how they react to other things, and I think... Let me not go there yet with them, because I think, let me find the right time. And then the times I feel I'm being withholding. But I'm not sure this is always going to be the right thing to tell. Sometimes it's better that I'm just more centered, as you said, and listen. I don't know. There are times when I think if somebody wanted to do active training, then I would speak up. I mean, I don't know.
This is your thing, right?
Yeah.
So you make your choices about this. But I would just encourage you to on the one hand, we can be evangelistic.
Yes.
And arrogant and presumptive, and and nobody likes that. Right? And Buddhism expressly discourages that, right? On the other hand, we can just be timid and shy or fearful, right, or insecure. And there's something about that within us. You've been doing this a long time, right? And so I talked yesterday about gaining confidence.
Yeah.
And not confidence that you use like a club, mm-hmm, but just... This is your life. This is who you are. If they're your friends, Mm-hmm. Right? They're already experiencing something. If this is having any impact on your life, they're already experiencing some of that without knowing. And just in because that's what friends do, they share different aspects of their life, you know, then it allows them to do whatever they would like to do with that.
Okay.
Which might be nothing. It might be questions. It might be interest. It might be joking about it. It might be thinking, oh, God, he's into that fad stuff. All right? Is that going to keep you from practicing?
No. No.
Stand on the ground. Cover the ground you stand on. It doesn't have to be a big deal.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be a secret.
Mm-hmm.
You sort that out.
Okay.
May your life go on.
Thank you.
When I was first living here, you know, when I talked to my parents, I didn't talk to them about, you know, Buddha nature and, you know, stuff like that. My mom, I talked about, you know, the community, the Sangha, things that were true and real, and that I thought she would relate to. And with my dad, I talked about the work that I was doing, because he was a business guy, stuff that he could relate to, as a way of just making contact and sharing in an honest way, different aspects of my life, and waiting to see if they were interested in, you know, asking questions about more, but not presuming, you know, that because this is so important to me, that, you know, I need to tell them everything, but also that I, you know, I didn't want to keep anything from them.
Shosanchi, how do I know my responsibility in responding to the fish trying to leave the water, the bird trying to leave the air?
I can't tell you that. But the bodhisattva vow, which you have taken, is to alleviate suffering. And so when you see suffering, right, you do what you can.
It's easier in responding to clients at one of my programs, or when there's permission, mm-hmm. when the relationship, when there's some kind of asking,
sure.
however subtle, when it's particularly hard with my mom. She's a devout Catholic, mm-hmm. and that's sincere. And I see her respond to me, to the world, in ways that's cultivating such division, fear of her safety, the safety of the country, and.
The question about, you know, when we become a student, right, we go through various processes of clarification, and when we go in to meet our teacher for the first time and do 9 bows, what do?
We ask. I ask you to teach me.
Yes.
Would you please teach me?
Yes. Very clear. We articulate in our own words. We ask. And that's a giving of permission, right? It's opening a door. And in fact, we need to keep doing that and keep doing that, keep giving permission. That makes it so much easier, right?
Yeah.
When a person is not asking for help, not giving permission, they have not opened the door to you, right?
Yeah.
How does a bodhisattva respond to that when the door is not open? With your vow to alleviate suffering.
Sometimes just be first noticing my inclination to step back, or when am I choosing to cultivate resentment? First choosing to cease from the harm that I'm creating on my side of that relationship.
Sure. Yeah, because clearly that's going to obstruct. And basically, when somebody is not open the door to you, then the question is, how can I serve you on this side of the door? How can I serve you from 2,000 miles away? How can I serve you when you won't talk to me? How can I serve you when you hate me? Right? When you're not seeing me, you don't know me, but you hate me. In other words, You face the reality. You know, I spoke about Yatsani's time, place, position, degree. Your place with regard to the person or the situation matters, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't determine whether you can do anything or not. It just shapes and informs what you might do. And so then thinking at, you know, at your most ever-present capacity, what is the one thing that you always have with you, no matter who's in front of you and what the situation is?
I have this.
What?
I'm here.
You have your mind. And with that, you can invoke compassion, you can invoke well-being for them, you can wish for them to be healed of their anger. When I used to live in the city those years, oftentimes I'd be on the street and on the subway, I'd be in the presence of clear suffering. And it did not seem appropriate, or maybe I didn't have the moral courage to step in and try and be more direct, but I would often do an invocation. I would do the four immeasurables right on the spot, right? In other words, you use your mind to create something good and have faith that just because you can't measure it, something is happening. In the same way that if you sat there and were judgmental and hating them and wishing that they would just disappear from this earth, that would also have some consequence, okay? May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosang Ji, during this week, talk song with you, and I expressed my concern about when I heard people, or I heard myself say, that's their karma. Mm-hmm. And that struck me when I hear this. I started to think about what is their karma and how those people killed and those people are sick, not knowing why. And how can I, then I realized that I need to look into the things itself. Like, the study showed, like I expressed to you, like the air we breathe, the water we drink, contains that forever chemical mm-hmm. created by the plastic things, and that make the Alzheimer's, brain tumor, all this. Mm-hmm. And so that's our karma. That I see this is the karma that created by our daily activities, mm-hmm. that without knowing the what's the cause and what's the consequences, mm-hmm. and how when I and the last Doksan, you say, okay, our karma, what can we do?
I said every day
yes.
we wake up with the question of what can I do?
What can I do? Yes. And so first I think I need to express my concern first to you. Like I sense that we need to know the information. We need to know the content. And we need education to know that why is this earth? What's the earth? What's the nature? Yes.
So you're doing some of that right now, right?
Yes, but yes.
Yeah.
And through my sitting, I sense that we have these capacities, that the nature in us, that our energy, our subtle energies, like we say, why we need to sit, mm-hmm. that energies arrive aligned with our energy and awareness.
So I want to go back to what you started with, where when we look at somebody and are thinking, what is their karma? So karma is, what are the actions that we see right now? Because karma is intentional action. What are the actions that have led up to this action? And importantly, what are the conditions that have fostered, nurtured, encouraged those particular actions today and going back into the past? So that is a way of reflecting, of trying to understand, when we think of a fixed sense of self, I mean, our language even says this, someone is bad. And what that actually say, the verb to be is to be. It's my existence. So if I am bad, that's just my existence. That's who I am, right? And even though we may not think that through, that's what the language is constantly reinforcing. And so when we see that we are each in this moment acting in a way that is a result of karmic actions and conditions, then it helps us to not solidify this sense of a quality or characteristic as within anyone, but rather there's an action. Is it helpful or not? What are the conditions that lead up to that? Could we change those, right? That's why the Buddha was so adamant about, when he would talk to people who had a lot of power, kings and lords and stuff, he tried to get them to lead in a just way, right? So in understanding karma, that can be very helpful because it helps to humanize each other. It helps us to understand that we are, just as we are, others are acting out of the results of their own karmic actions, their conditions, and we're all a part of it, which means we have a mutual responsibility to each other. No one's thoughts, words, and actions comes completely from within themselves, as though they have lived in a vacuum their whole life. We're all influenced. And so in that way, we share that responsibility. All right, may your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanshi, I am involved in an organization right now where there have been a couple people who have been acting out and causing harm to myself and others in the group. And it's gone on for a while, and it hasn't been addressed. And past me might have let it just pretend, just accepted. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't feel right to me anymore. Mm-hmm. I can't witness that harm. Mm-hmm. And so I've been speaking up. Mm-hmm. Hopefully skillfully, I feel it's been skillful, to say that this isn't okay, mm-hmm. this type of speech. Mm-hmm. And I feel that's the right thing for me to do. And for these people, I'm causing them harm. And
so how do you see that? How do the precepts that you have taken as your own vows speak to that? Guide you in that?
I have compassion for them.
But you just said you're causing them harm.
I am.
And so, how do you understand that harm that you're creating?
Well,
how can you bring that into your vows? Because the precepts speak to that.
I can atone.
Well, let's, before we get to atonement.
I can't just jump over there.
Well, that's assuming something important. Mm. When you speak up, what is your intention in doing that?
My intention is to stop harm.
Okay. And in doing that, because you're speaking up, you think that that might be causing them some harm.
Okay. Well, yes, they indicate that sometimes.
So is your intention to cause them harm?
No.
Right. So the harm that they're experiencing as a result of your speaking up, your hope might be what?
My hope might be, wait, can you say that again?
You're speaking up.
Yep.
It seems to be causing them harm.
Yeah.
But your aim in doing that is what?
Is to help others.
What about them?
Well, sometimes I hope that they might see that what they're doing is causing harm to other people. Okay. And be like, well,
Okay. And would that help them?
I hope so.
So sometimes we act in a way that causes harm in a moment for a larger good. I mean, the precepts are very clear about this. Mm-hmm. Because there are many situations in which any action you take is going to make somebody unhappy.
Right.
And so, but not acting is just another action that will have its own consequence.
It's right? painful.
And so to be bold, to be clear-minded, thoughtful, you know, to reflect, what would be skillful? You know, so standing up in the middle of a meeting is one way to do it. To talk to them privately, you know, because that can be very sort of confrontive in a way. To talk to them privately, you know, how to talk to them. You know, one way is, you know, you need to stop doing this, right? Another approach is, you know, when you do this, this is what I experience, right? Because they can't deny that.
Exactly.
They can't deny your experience. They can deny when you point to them and, you know, say whatever. So being skillful. But so we have to be able to do that, to take responsibility for some harm that we might be creating, but with conviction, not just the hope, but the conviction that this is going to lead to something better. Because not acting, as you said, is just continuing to create an unhealthy situation that you're all part of.
Mm-hmm.
And so to not act, whether it's to preserve ourselves, whether it's to avoid conflict, is to really collaborate and be part of a harm that is now becoming larger.
Yeah.
Right? And so to be able to step forward and you know, I mean, that's a kind of moral courage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're doing it based in, I hope, not a sense that, you know, you have the truth.
No. I wouldn't want to do it, trust me. I'm not like, I'd rather
so
be quiet.
You have to actually override an impulse to not speak.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's a courage to do that, right? Because you're sticking your neck out.
Yeah. And if they get mad at me, they get mad at me.
Well, then what?
Well.
Because it's not over.
No, it's actually not over, so.
So you attend to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it can mean reflecting on what you're doing. Should you keep doing what you're doing? Are there other ways?
Yeah.
You know, what doesn't belong to you?
That's the thing.
So you're not taking on what really isn't yours to take on. You know, I mean, that's when Dogen said, actually, it's not. I haven't read it yet. I'm going to finish with this. But to know your mind, to study the self, so that in those moments you can be reasonably clear, if not quite clear, of where you stand.
Mm-hmm.
May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
When I was in fifth grade, everyone in my class had to memorize Rudyard Kipling's poem, If. And we each had to recite it. So I not only had to recite it 1,000 times to myself, I had to listen to every other kid recite it. If you can keep your head while all those about you have losing theirs and blaming it on you.
Shosanji, I am here on the matter of life and death at the monastery with you on this path. I'm wondering why I'm so scared. This is the scariest thing, just sitting here in front of my Sangha and my teacher.
It is.
It's scarier than anything I do in my life, and I've got 1,070 skydives. But that's why I'm here. I don't know exactly what to ask, but I want to talk to you all the time when I'm in Australia, when things come up, death, my fear of death.
What are you afraid of? Are you afraid of the dying process or of being dead?
The dying process.
And what about that?
It's ugly. It's frightening. You have no control.
You've witnessed it.
Yes. Yeah.
And so death is a certainty. How we die is going to be is unknown, right? In terms of what the conditions will be, we don't know until we're there. And so how can you prepare yourself so you don't just live fearfully?
I am preparing myself.
Exactly. You are. How? How are you preparing yourself?
Well, I sit this really uncomfortable practice of Zazen.
So how is that preparing you? How is that preparing you?
To meet my mind, because I know how hard it is to practice when I'm healthy and strong. I'm healthy and strong and of sound mind, I think. But when I'm dying, I know when I'm in a really bad state, I find it really hard to sit still.
That's right.
And so when I'm dying sick, I don't want to just go, okay, I'll have that bottle of whatever, or I don't know, just mm-hmm. not practice.
You'd like to be there for it.
Yes, I want to be there.
Okay. So, sort of.
No, I don't want it now. Yeah.
Okay. We won't do it now then.
Although,
but for real, you know, I mean, all of the teachings about, you know, preparation for death, and there are a lot of teachings in different schools of Buddhism, but they almost all the times that I've come across this from different teachers, they almost always will at some point say, in matter of fact, the practice that you're doing all the time is your training. You're meeting the reality that's in front of you, not the one you asked for. Not the one you imagine, not the perfect one. Sometimes you don't like it. Sometimes it's really painful. Sometimes you're in a state that makes it hard to meet that reality in front of you, right? But you sit on the cushion and you make a commitment that you're not going to fly away. You're not going to leave your element, right? And so you make a commitment to how am I going to find my way here now when I feel compromised, right? I don't have full access to all my, you know, capacities. And you find a way to do that, right? It's different than when you feel great, but it's real, right? You're training yourself to meet that reality in all these different states, right? How many different states did you experience this past week? A few?
10,000.
Yeah. Some high, some low, some open-hearted, some closed-hearted. What amazing training, right? And all of this passes by. It's not the moment of your death, but in another way, each of those moments is born and dies. The good ones that you want to keep forever, you can't. The hard ones that you'd wish would go away stay a little longer, but they pass too. And you're seeing that in each moment, you can be born. You can create your mind. You can bring your mind to that particular moment. You know, I heard the Dalai Lama say once he was talking, and he said that, talking about how at the time of his death, you know, because of all of his training, you know, he would be dedicating all the merit of his life to all sentient beings. So in the moment of his finality, his mind would be for the welfare of others. He said, but then he paused and he says, but I don't know if I go down in a plane crash suddenly, I don't know what I'll do. And I thought that was so right on, right? I mean, for me, I would definitely say the same. I don't know. I don't know. I have hopes. I have intentions. I train so that I can draw in that moment easily from that training, but I can't predict it, right? May your life go on.
Thank you for the teaching.
Shosanji. When I was little, my dad harmed me very profoundly, and he did denies it, and my mom denies that it could be possible, and so I can't be around them because it's too painful. And in June, I missed my grandfather's funeral because they were there. And soon my cousins will probably get married, and I feel like I won't be able to be there for that either. And I don't understand how it could be designed that way. Can you explain?
No, I can't explain it. It's not really a design. It's not. It's individual actions that people create that cause, and sometimes lasting harm. But the harm that we carry with us, right, while we may carry it all of our lives, how we carry it is really open. There's an open door there. We can carry it like this, you know, like a heavy burden on our shoulders. We can carry it lightly. You know, some people think, when I was working in the prisons a lot for many years, you know, and I worked with people who'd committed horrendous crimes and were practitioners and taken vows of the Bodhisattva, were really transforming their lives. And sometimes they would speak about forgetting. I mean, they would speak about letting go. And they would say, no, I don't want to let go of what I did. Why? Because they wanted to remember. They didn't want to forget. And I would say, you're never going to forget. You'll always remember. But how you remember, how you carry that can be different. When something has happened to us, right, and there's not sort of the best way of repairing that, where the injuring party takes responsibility, right, rather than harming, shows love, right, and does whatever they can to help repair that wound, but that's not always there. And so then it really leaves it up to the injured to, in a sense, and it seems like a heavy burden because it's not your fault. Like it shouldn't fall on your shoulders. But you're the one who's living your life. So it really does come down to you. And so it begins with the question of, how do you want to live? Now, what do you want to do about this? But how do you want to live? Do you want to keep carrying it? Some people do. It becomes a cause, it becomes an identity. But if the answer is no, I don't want to carry this my whole life, that's really decisive. It's like a vow. So now, being clear about that, what do I need to do to bring the parts of my life into alignment with that commitment, that decision, and that's going to help me do that? Honestly, come to carry this in a different way, carry it more lightly. And so reaching out to others to be a part of that may not be viable, right? Sometimes resolution to an ugly event, a very harmful event, when there's not that possibility of doing something together, which is ultimately the best way of doing it, because then everybody has some healing. Sometimes the resolution is, this was a terrible thing. It should not have happened. It did. And the resolution is just facing that and accepting it. Realizing I can't change that past, but I have a lot of power in terms of what I do today. And so from the outside, it doesn't look very resolved, but inwardly, it's a path towards resolution, because now I'm not fighting anymore. I'm not wishing or thinking it shouldn't have happened, it should have been different, or this should happen. Those things aren't happening, or they can't happen. So now I'm standing on the ground that I'm covering. I'm standing in my own completeness. I'm not waiting for anybody else. And so then I go about the work. We have, you know, different ways of practicing that. I mean, the essential way is what you've been doing all week. So to face the pain, right, the effect of what has happened to you, having the courage to speak of that here today in front of all of these people, right? These are all really, really important steps, changing steps. It helps you to pivot, right? Because in that, you have strength right? We feel your strength in that. And so you just keep taking those steps. And then how, if and how, you relate to your family is a question. And it's not a, it may be a question of what you're doing now. Maybe you keep doing that. You know, it's causing you pain, right? Because there are family members that you're missing their parts of their life, and that's causing you a lot of pain. If you were to go, there would be another pain that you would have to face, right? Sometimes that's the choice we're given. And so you choose. And what I would just encourage you to do, whatever choice you're making, choose that. So if you choose to continue to cut off communication with them, then choose that completely and take responsibility for the consequences. That means I will not be there for my cousin's wedding. I wasn't there for, and just feel the pain of that. But choose it. If you choose to go, take responsibility for whatever that might come. But it's you, right? It's not something that's happening to you. Because then you continue to stand on the cover the ground on which you stand. Okay? And in that way, the way this sits in you, because it's not fixed, will continue to transform. Okay?
Thank you.
Let Dio come up.
No, I was a
placeholder. Oh, you're a placeholder. Okay, fine. You're
from Onion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I see everybody knows everything's under control. I don't have to manage this.
So Sanji, when I sense what I perceive to be a fish out of its water, a bird out of the air, I question to what degree is that my idea of how the water should be or how the air should be, or it's my element that's being somehow disturbed. And I do feel a certain degree of pain in encountering something that feels out of accordance. But I think over time, it's just a matter of bearing it, living my life, taking each step as it comes. Mm-hmm. And
you know, from within samsara, we try and create an element that is our basis, that we live within, that is our air and water, that is filled with things that we have give us pleasure, and our identities and status and power and whatever, you know, we think is going to give us what we want. But in that, we have to have doors in that field, so that the bad stuff doesn't come in. And then we try and stay in it and preserve it and not get pulled out, right? And so that just never works. And so to realize this basic element, to realize your mind, the nature of your mind, it's not a place, it's not a thing, it can't be possessed, no one can take it, no one can give it. And so then you're free. You're free of fear, you're free of having to defend and protect, you're free of being threatened, right? You're not free of the adversity that happens in life, right? People acting badly and it happening to you. You're not free of that. But you're free of preserving that, solidifying that, making that who you are, what your life is about. May your life go well.
Thank you.
Shoshanji. The fish, the bird, myself, when I see them out of the water.
Can you hold that up? Speak a little louder.
I have
can't help but go back to what you had said to me in Tokusan and asked me about mind. And I think I get hooked by that word, mind, and forget.
That's a professional...
That's a professional hazard.
Exactly.
Indeed. And, well, in my profession, and when relating to myself, when I've been out of water, if I go there, I'm lost. But if I remember this, I see someone else, and I allow that tender heart to just break slightly, it's that which shows me the way. It is the way. It is what brought me to the way. It's why I'm here now.
And so seeing that so clearly, why then does the heart close back up again?
Because I go here, and I get lost here, and
when you say here, what does that mean?
My head.
What does that mean?
My mind. My thinking mind. My rational mind. All the accumulation of conditioning.
Does your thinking mind have no role in this?
Oh, it has been trained.
No, but in this path.
In this path?
Mm.
Yes. In my training, I bring that mind to bear, and I train it like a good horse to run fast, and hopefully at the shadow of the whip, it's going to move.
But what about in the moment when you're in the front of someone and you go up into your thinking mind?
Yes.
And your heart closes?
Yes.
And you think, oh, I'm caught up in my thoughts.
Yes.
Right?
It's that mind.
That thought.
Yes.
So the thinking mind has a useful role.
So is the thinking mind, how does it relate to bodhicitta? Because that's what I'm relying on to keep me on the path.
Well, bodhicitta is raising the mind and thought of awakening. Citta means both mind and thought.
That's right, okay.
So how wonderful that we can... I mean, if we couldn't express it and articulate it, it might just be a sort of fuzzy, wobbly, what?
Yes.
But articulation, I mean, it goes both ways. So sometimes when you articulate, things become so defined and limited and narrow.
Yeah.
But in another sense, they become clear and concise.
Yes, that is true.
Right? When we recognize that when we give voice to our aspiration, we're not nailing any, we're not defining anything. We're releasing something.
Yes.
Letting something that has been very small now become large.
Yes.
The Bodhisattva vow.
Yes.
May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanchi. Can a bird leave the sky?
Can a bird leave the sky?
Can we ever not cover the ground on which we stand?
And so?
And so...
What's to be done?
It turns out nothing.
And so, to ensure that people don't go down to their spaghetti with confusion in their mind.
Well, nothing means because nothing's to be done, we have the 16 precepts and we have the 4 bodhisattva vows and we have each other and the teachings.
And what about the things you can't speak of? What about the forbidden things?
Yeah.
What's to be done about those? That.
I don't understand.
I know. And I love you for that. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
I was just thinking how wonderful it is to be in the midst of a Sangha in which we can speak about easy and difficult things, solid and ineffable things together. I was remembering many years ago when Jimon, my beloved partner, was Shuso. And at the Dharma encounter combat before Shuso Hosen, which we used to do on Thursday evenings, I think, with just a few residents and local folks, everybody went up every time. And he did the Dharma encounter. And as he was doing, after he did his bows, he turned to Jimon and said, something like, good luck next month. These guys are really sharp. And she went into Dokusan afterwards and said, Dino, you're scaring me. Or something like that. I don't know if that's exactly what you said, if you're listening. So sorry if I misquoted you. As things would happen, this morning I was looking at a text that I'd never seen before. It's an ancient text from the first or second century, and it just seemed to perfectly speak to this that we've spoken about today and in a small way, in a large way. So I'd like to end with this. Blessed one, when the best of bipeds, the Buddha, has entered nirvana, we are now still capable of sustaining the holy Dharma. We will give up our attachments to wealth and prestige. We will give up our attachments to praise. We will not give up this Dharma. Sustaining this way of life during very terrible times, when kings and ordinary beings are in turmoil, in ages of destruction, for the sake of sentient beings, we will sustain this great Dharma. Many will not understand what is true and untrue. They will say very strange things. While sustaining this way of life, we will develop loving kindness for those who are not committed to the Dharma, to what is true, and we will have compassion for them. When we see morally undisciplined sentient beings who are committed to desire and greed, we will shed tears for them. We will feel compassion for them. As much as possible, we will guard our acts of speech. We will not speak harshly to those who are committed to their own wrong actions. With gifts and with acts of respect, we can help people to become more mature. As we are disciplining and making ourselves more peaceful and free, we can now enter the village, the valley, the city streets, and do what we can to alleviate the sufferings of those who are searching for the Dharma. Having seen clearly the many forms of confusion of sentient beings living with confidence in the Dharma, we will completely understand ourselves. Some people, when they hear the truthful admonitions, will throw away those words. They will turn away and have disdain for liberation teachings. Just as people whose noses and ears have been cut off don't enjoy looking in a mirror when they hear truthful admonitions, they won't listen to this Dharma. Kings will be deceived. The population will be divided. But by the power of the Buddha, some sentient beings will hear the Dharma in this current age, in order to help sentient beings, even in bodily pain, having given up our bodies and lives, we will sustain this Dharma. May we live and practice that kind of faith and conviction. This was written a long, long time ago. Unruly kings, divisions within the people. This is our time. We can use all of this to despair and crawl into a cave. We can use all of this to bring forth that kind of conviction in this Dharma, in human beings, in each other.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.